Hey there. Welcome to Sauce and Bomb Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Nadana, Head of Growth at Sauce Group. So you're LaGuardia buying wonderful sauce businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. So today with me is Jason, founder at Zigpool, helping e-commerce brands get a deeper understanding of their customers by using micro surveys. And I guess you're not just working with e-commerce, but we'll get there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. So
Sure.
excited to be here to chat about things.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome to have you here. I was researching about the tool a little bit more and just kind of crawling through the website and everything. And it's pretty exciting. But before we get there, let's get to your background and how you got to do what you're doing.
How did I get here? Good question. I used to work at an e-commerce agency. This was, almost a decade ago as a front developer. So knew sort of the ins and outs about development and thought, hey, I'm burning all of this time and energy into, building products for someone else and not seeing sort of the fruits of my labor. And I thought, well, hey, why don't, you take some time and try and sort of do it for yourself and see if you can get something off the ground. And that was sort of like the motivation to get started. And because sort of I'm a solo guy, I had a team, but I sort of wanted to work alone as I think, you get kind of burnt out working with a team and sort of like, delegating tasks and stuff like that. So the dream is to sort of work for myself. And so because of that, I sort of focused, on the Shopify App Store to begin with, because that was sort of a distribution channel that would allow me to sort of just focus on the product and they would handle the rest. And that was sort of how I got started, sort of with e-commerce and sort of building Shopify apps in general, which led me to Zigpool ultimately.
Okay, interesting. Now the fact that you're an engineer probably explains that you have this documentation page. And honestly, I was researching about Zigpool and I Googled. Yes, I do still Google. It sounds like so old school now, right? Everyone
Yeah,
ChatGPTs now, so.
I know. It hit you fast. I feel like it was just yesterday I was Googling without being told the answer from, some sort of AI agent.
Yeah, absolutely. The first page I actually got to was your documentation page, and I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. Like it looks very unique, but like there is button down, there is improv max that look kind of the same. So I thought that was great, but then I started thinking that maybe it's more tailored towards like tech founders or tech users, or at least you need somebody technical to implement it. But maybe it's just because you're an engineer, and it's just kind of the way you see it being a bit more logical.
Yeah, that's funny. Me personally, I don't know if that's actually the actual outcome. I think it may be just sort of search ranking with the docs page, just because documentation in general is kind of a chore for me. So, but we made it. We got there, and you found it, which is, of course, the best possible outcome. I will say that, yeah, when you get started, or at least when I got started, being a developer, being the guy that builds the product, my first sort of instinct, in terms of selling the product was, posted on, Hacker News, posted on sort of these like software focused, show me your project sort of things, like subreddits, stuff like that. And that's useful, to get started. You kind of like have to start there, post on products on it, do all that sort of stuff. But the sort of light bulb moment, at least in terms of growth and sort of figuring out, how to actually get this product into the hands of customers who will use it, is to sort of take a step back, think about who's actually going to be using this product. And, in my case, it wasn't like sometimes, yeah, like a software developer is going to use Zigpool to, create a survey, for their SaaS business or something like that. But more often it's going to be a marketer or, someone with a different role. It's not exactly, on the front lines, coding, although now maybe they are with AI and stuff like that. Sort of getting to understand who's actually going to use your product and then focusing on them, is a super important sort of like part of the life cycle of when you build your product, right? Like, okay, so you built it. Now you understand this is what it is. This is what it does. And then you got to understand sort of who's it for. And I think, some folks have the foresight to sort of figure that all out in advance. But for me, I just wanted to hit the ground running, build something, and then sort of see where it took me. So yeah, just, like fun fact about sort of, building products and sort of like the life cycle of how it goes. As a developer, I feel like the initial instinct is to just go straight into the people you know. But that may not be the best, or it may not be the final outcome, if that makes sense. We should always be sort of iterating.
Yeah, absolutely. But who is the buyer? And like in this case, if you sometimes need tech folks to kind of work with what you created, but then the buyer is different. How does it affect your marketing?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, then how does that position you in terms of your language, in terms of your user experience? What's the first thing that people see? In your case, maybe because sort of you have this sort of focus on SaaS products, and you interview them, maybe that's how you land on the docs page first. Or maybe I need to do a better job, on the marketing page. Either one, but both are possible. So using that sort of ideal customer profile to inform, everything, from the user experience to the onboarding flow to the landing page, the splash sites, all that sort of stuff. It's super important, and it's sort of the only way to drive growth. So that's been sort of in the later stages of, okay, step one, Jason, can you build a product? Okay, yes. Step two, can you put it in the hands of a few people? It's like yes. And then it's like step three is like, can you now refine the product to make it ideal for the person who's using it and add the most value, and also the person who's willing to pay. Both of those things kind of matter. I mean, depending on what you're building, of course, but sort of that's sort of the third step, and who knows what four and five are going to be. That's sort of where I'm at now.
Okay. That makes complete sense. But also, it's because I obviously went through documentation as well, and there are so many ways to work with that. And for some, if you're on Shopify, like you said, it's fairly simple. Like at least that's what it says. Like it's basically a push of a button. But then it can be a bit more technical if you're doing something a bit more custom for you for your SaaS. How does it affect, in this case, your roadmap and what you're developing? Is it, are you still focusing a bit more on Shopify because it's your main growth channel and that's what gets delivered first, or how do you prioritize?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know, since I haven't spoken to a lot of sort of Shopify developers, how many people sort of feel this way. But for me, Shopify is, it's an amazing tool to get started. I think it was definitely much more useful in 2018, 2019, whenever I launched SigPull, just because there was less volume on the App Store, and it was their UX was laid out a bit differently. But it's still a good channel, right? Like if you're a solo developer and you don't want to worry about growth to get started, and you want to get a couple grand MRR just to validate your idea, you should try it out on the Shopify App Store if it has a use in the e-commerce space. The issue is sort of you can grow very big. Like there are some apps on there that do a million plus, probably more than that. But you're focused in on a niche, and the Shopify ecosystem is, they really want to keep people within their ecosystem. So you're gonna sort of at some point get a little bit hamstrung or bogged down with, making sure that you fit in nicely to the Shopify ecosystem, or else someone's going to jump to another app that does. And that's tricky because it restricts sort of how you can grow your product and sort of what use cases. So anyway, so that's just a long way of saying, I'm trying to do both, but you're kind of, you should focus on the channel sort of that's working for you. And right now that is Shopify. So the main focus is Shopify, but I've always sort of looking out the corner of my eye being like, hey, oh, this is a cool use case from, someone. I think one of them is like a deli, right? So they use the survey to send links out to their customers, after they create a purchase or after they get a delivery to see how the food was, stuff like that. It's like, okay, so maybe we could look into that space. Maybe we could look into hotels or WordPress, all this sort of stuff, because someone uses it and picks up the product. But in order to devote sort of the time and effort and sort of to enter the market, it's a big undertaking. So in time, trying to sort of get away a little bit and, diversify, because I think that's important. But, Shopify is a great growth channel. So I don't know. I guess, advice would be to use Shopify sort of as a springboard, but then always sort of try and keep your options open and keep looking out to see if you could hit it somewhere else. Because if you can, you have way more control over that distribution channel. There's a lot more levers you can pull than if you're just on the Shopify App Store. So it's important to sort of build a brand identity outside of that as well.
Yeah, and brand is something that I really want to ask you about, but I also wanted to ask you a bit more about the Shopify App Store because I was talking to a few founders who were there, or they have a Chrome extension, and what they were saying is that basically it's always catching up with the reviews that you have there, making sure that your customers are happy, and just kind of trying to always be there on top so people kind of see you at all times, because like you said, there are tons of different other apps that have maybe a similar use case, you know, maybe have, I don't know, more budget to allocate to their marketing or whatever. So yeah, and there were quite a few very interesting tricks that they shared. Like, for example, one founder said that, you know, whenever we have like a complaint or maybe a founder saying, oh, you know, guys, like we are going to this higher tier in pricing and it's not very comfortable for us, they're like, okay, you know what? We'll offer you lower tier. We'll grandfather you, but we want to make sure that you're satisfied and, you know, our reviews are great. So we're still there on top and we don't want to lose that position because otherwise we will jeopardize our growth channel. So how does it work for you? What do you have any tricks on how to stay on top of mind of Shopify?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I fully agree with whoever said that, right? Reviews are absolutely the most important part of at least starting off in the Shopify app store, right? Like you need to have minimum of 55 star reviews before anyone's going to start taking you seriously. You know, how you get those, it's up to you. You know, there are lots of different ways. Probably like cold emailing, like you hustle, you figure it out, right? You get people to install your app and then, you know, I don't know, just chat with them is probably the best way and build a relationship and then get them to leave a review. But you need to constantly be getting them all the time or else you will drop your rank quickly and then you'll lose pretty much all the value of having that distribution channel, especially now because there's so many apps, you know, discovery is kind of a challenge. So yeah, so if you're starting off, you know, customer success, customer support, you know, you should consider that your superpower. You know, that I do every customer support ticket today. You know, I still do them. It's actually kind of becoming a problem, but I answer every single email. I do every single support ticket. You know, we send out follow-up emails, like, you know, asking to make sure you're okay and stuff like that. And yeah, and we do give out discounts, you know, if someone's uncomfortable. You know, it's just another lever you can pull, right? So having sort of like a bunch of discount options, you know, and maybe in the beginning you do it manually, you know, later on you create discount codes, stuff like that. It's just a useful tool in your toolbox, especially to diffuse situations. Cause like some people come in hot, you know, I've had people come in with curse words and then end up leaving a 5-star review. You know, the point is you just have to respond, you know, relatively quickly and say like, I totally hear you. You know, like I understand, you know, just like general sort of customer service stuff, you know, think, be empathetic. And then also just having sort of like that sweet spot of being able to offer a review, like offer an incentive, you know, whether it's like half off or 50% off or, you know, 75% off even in some cases. And just help the customer feel heard. That goes a long way. Even if they end up uninstalling, you know, the app or something like that later, it was still worth it, right? Because that exchange, you know, got your review. Even if it didn't end up leading to revenue now, it will lead to revenue later in terms of discovery. So yeah, it's stressful, you know, the customer support's stressful and, you know, being sort of at the mercy of pretty much anyone who installs your app is stressful. And I certainly commiserate with anyone who feels like that's, you know, I can't handle it anymore. I get it. But I do think it's, if you're going to go the app store route, if you're going to go the marketplace route, really in any marketplace, right? Whether it's, you know, the Atlassian marketplace or, you know, the apps, maybe less on the Apple app store, but I would say it's probably still important. When you're starting, your main focus is to get those reviews. Cause if you get a 1-star review and you've less than 20, you're almost dead in the water. Like it's really tough to recover from that. So yeah, so, you know, that's definitely a critical part.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And, you know, to what you just said about, you know, the whole customer support, customer communication becoming a problem, when we were thinking about a few ways to grow a few products, even within SaaS group, you know, one of the ideas was to, you know, there are millions of those directories and, you know, you never know where people will end up and where they will find your tool. And we thought, okay, maybe it could be a good idea to just kind of go out there and like take the, I don't know, the list of 500 of those and list the tools there and, you know, kind of just test and see what works. And then we realized that like at the end of the day, like with all those reviews, with all those questions incoming, it will be a bitch to like, to take care of all of it, right? And just kind of trying to keep up. And yeah, we decided against it because, you know, nobody has the time to just kind of keep an eye on all of them. So double down on a few and then take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it's important to support. If you're going to do something, do it right. You know, like see it through and be able to support it. I will say though that my volume of the amount of emails I'm able to respond to is high, and it's higher than I think I ever thought it could be. So, give it a shot. It may be worth it. It may not. You may end up, like me and be like, I'm tired all the time. But there are sort of ways to handle, like, if you do enough volume of customer support, one thing that's huge for me and that, I probably wouldn't be able to service many people without is just creating sort of like email templates. So like sort of like pre-built responses to things that come up. And this doubles also as, making sure that your product roadmap actually fits the problems people are having. Cause, you'll see over time that pattern starts to emerge. People are saying, how do I do this? And then, you get another one. 2 days later, 2 weeks later, whatever. As long as they're consistent, you now know that you have a gap in your user experience that you need to fix. And yeah, that was kind of a drag on my time to like click, templates and. But you've now identified a very real problem with your app that you can now fix. And then eventually you fix it. And then, someone comes up with a new problem. Then you create a new template and then, you sort of so on and so forth. So it's been an interesting sort of journey for me to realize just how important and how much of a superpower listening to customers and doing your own customer support actually is. Because at first you would think like, oh, this is, I just can't wait to outsource this to someone else. But it really is important, at least to read them. Maybe you don't have to respond to all of them. But it just, reading all of them has been super important for me, at least in terms of sort of developing a good product or a product that people actually want. So that's it. Yeah.
Any AI that you're using there, because you said templates, and my mind like immediately went to a few tools
Yeah.
that I've been using.
It's funny. I'm like fast and slow to respond to AI. First, I think I added the AI insights tool to Zigpool, right? So it'll take your data and then it'll generate some insights automatically in the background. I did that like right when ChatGPT came out, 2 years ago, 2+ years ago. But yeah, when it comes to sort of these other tools, like do this email for me and stuff like that, I've been a little bit slow to adopt. So no, I suppose you could. I think that might save me some time. But this is just literally like Gmail templates, right? Like you can create a template in Gmail, whenever you write an email that you feel like you might send again. And that's been really useful. But no AI emails yet, though I've encountered some, when buying something online or whatever, and you have that sort of experience with the AI. Is it there yet? I don't know. Personally, I don't think so, but maybe I just haven't noticed, right? Like, when maybe I've had a good conversation with a robot and I've been none the wiser.
Okay, interesting. I may recommend you one of the tools that I've been using. It's
Yeah,
not like
please.
kind of it kind of learns how you're responding, and I even asked a few colleagues if they noticed that it wasn't really me. I mean, they were pretty short and kind of like, okay, yes, like let's do this, and kind of, I don't know, scheduling stuff. But it was still super helpful. I don't know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, do you want, what's the name of the tool? Is it?
I believe it's a Fixer with a Y.
Of course. Okay, cool. Got it.
Yeah, of
I got
course.
it. Yeah.
Yes, obviously. Can it just be a normal Fixer?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny that you mentioned brand, because that was one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, because I just had a conversation with another founder just a couple of days ago, and we were really going like heavy on branding, because well, I believe in branding very deeply, and I think it just moves the needle so much. But yeah, we figured that a lot of companies, especially the early stage, they're like, yeah, okay, well, let's focus on the product. Let's focus on like a bit of SEO and stuff. And content obviously helps, because you like develop your tone of voice and stuff. But a lot of founders postpone kind of really investing in branding. So what do you do, and what works for you?
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think I'm probably late to the party here, and probably not. I think if there's room for me to improve, I think it would be in branding. You know, I fancy myself somewhat of a digital artist, or at least, you know, I have some Photoshop chops, right? You know, as you sort of grow, you realize that like you don't really know much about anything, and that everyone else is doing a pretty good job. You know, designers are designers for a reason. But you know, to date, I've done all the branding sort of myself, right? So like the logo, all that sort of stuff, that's all me. Yeah, and but I wish I would have sort of honed in on improving that sooner to have a consistent brand identity. So like previously we had used just like Wait Me. I'd used just like an icon that I found, you know, from like Font Awesome or something as sort of like, you know, the logo, just like a little bit of color tweaks or something. And that got me to a certain point. But when we started doing ads, and sort of having like, you know, promotional materials and marketing materials, it was hard to sort of keep it consistent just because like there wasn't really a great visual identity to sort of tie it all together. So I think if you can, I would say the answer to sort of everything, if there's like a heuristic you can follow, is to keep it simple, like simpler than you think, right? Like my initial reaction is to overcomplicate things, you know, with multiple colors and different colors for different ideas and different ways of using the product. And it's like, no. Just have a single, simple, visually cohesive, you know, icon that you can use that's uniquely yours. And then that's also an important part, that it's uniquely yours, that it's not like shared with someone else, you know, that you see this and you're like, you know, like, okay, like that's the font, that's the icon, together there as a whole, that's it. Just sort of to hone in on that and use that as sort of like a central you know, tool to tie all of your marketing materials together. I think that's the brand, right? Like just the sort of like the center that sort of collects all of your marketing materials together and is at least somewhat cohesive. And the simpler that your brand identity is, the more cohesive sort of things can be. You know, granted, you don't want to be all things to all people. You know, it's a tug and pull, right? It's like how far do you niche down versus how broad do you go? So I think my sort of very loose answer should explain that I'm still sort of figuring this out. You know, I think the brand is, you know, it's just okay as far as, you know, my sort of understanding and development of it. And it can definitely be
Interesting.
improved. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, there's just so many questions, right? Like how much do you want to focus on certain things? You know, like do you want to take a position, you know, like in some sort of like area, you know, whether it's, you know, technology stack or whether it's like political or whatever, you know, it's a tough question, right? Like, you know, I think the most important thing is that you get yourself out there in any way, shape, or form. You know, I think that, you know, not doing anything is the only thing that is wrong, you know, like you know, I don't think I could say there's a right answer, but doing nothing is definitely the wrong answer. So yeah, but you know, getting there. I'm not, and you know, maybe you have some ideas on how to improve the brand, but I think it's
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
absolutely. Like, and that's why I said it's so interesting because when we were talking about it, we were like, okay, what is brand? And a lot of people go to visual identity first. And you know, I mean, I'm the one to talk, right? Like this thing has been around LinkedIn, and you know, people are saying, okay, purple is sales script. Like when we see a shirt with anything purple, we know it's you guys. And you know, it helps obviously, because like you said, just simplify it. You know, it's nothing too fancy. It's just, you know, the background. But the kind of the ultimate goal was just discussing like how do you layer stuff on this visual identity? Like how do you communicate your values? How important is actually to have a brand and to have somebody relate to your brand if you're in B2B? Like, does it really matter if you go to Shopify App Store? Like, does it matter if, you know, Zigbull has a brand or, you know, I just want an app that solves my problem, solves it fast, you know, it's a push of a button, like you said, and, you know, it's done.
I mean, I think this goes back to sort of the idea of like, who's your customer, right? You know, I think if your customer is, you know, Mr. Developer who sees SaaS as like a tool in the toolbox and he's like, I need this, you know, whatever Excel exporter for my product inventories, you know, for, you know, backlogging dates to send to warehouse or something, then whatever, you know what I mean? Like, then the name of the product should be, you know, exporter for variants to send to warehouse. But if it's more to someone, I think, is using your product in order to sort of like, put their own stamp on it and to put their own spin on it, and like, hey, I'm going to use Zigbull to create my own sort of like custom KPI reporting based on these sort of questions that I came up with, or you know, maybe I want to, you know, run an NPS just to this specific cohort, you know, for these dates who purchased this product, and then send it back to my boss. then the brand identity starts to matter because, you know, it's, yes, there are a lot of survey tools, but this one is the one that I can use to create the value. You know, this is the one that I know how to use. And so it becomes more important. So it depends on who you're selling to. But I think in my case, the brand actually matters more than I initially thought, right? Like, I think I was thinking, oh, another survey tool, but this one is like pulls on site. It has all these cool features that you can use, exit intent, all this sort of stuff. That should be enough. But I don't think that's true. I think you also do need to have a brand identity, even if you're selling B2B. Like, I think that is, you know, B2B, you definitely need a brand identity for B2B, unless you're selling, you know, just like a widget for a software developer. It's very important, probably maybe more important than you might think.
Absolutely agree. No, I think there are like, again, layers in this. Like some companies don't need like that big of a brand, and some definitely do. Like we have Rewardful, which is, you know, a great brand, and you know, I love them very much and what they're doing and how they support their values and what they stand for with their content as well. But you know, there are some brands that we own that don't necessarily think they need like a brand identity. Like they work, like you said, they're just like this one little tool that does the job, mm-hmm. and that's what matters. But you know, talking about Rewardful, I noticed that you guys have links for affiliates. And, you know, because we do so much of this educational content around affiliates, I was wondering how do you do it and how do you make sure that you find those affiliates that work and that make sense for you?
Yeah, that's been kind of tricky for us, affiliates. You know, it works okay. We have, I think, a couple hundred. But, you know, just the straightforward answer of like, what was our strategy is just to offer the best, like the best value, right? So we offer 50% revenue share forever, right? Like that's a very aggressive, you know, very good value. If you hear that, you're like, well, I can sell Zigpool. It's a good product. You should, you know, cause it's, you know, you're going to get a lot of money back forever and it's going to bleed me dry. I'm kidding. We have very good margins, so it doesn't matter. And that's, I think, sort of like a little secret, right? Like, you know, why are you worrying about the ultimate about the price when your margins are, you know, pretty much infinite, you know, like having another customer, like, yeah, sure. There's a little bit of like overhead with generating like AI insights from, you know, AI providers and web hosting and stuff, but really in aggregate, it's not much. So anything you can do to drive growth, you know, is the right thing to do, at least in my opinion. And also while you're small, right? Like before you're spending on like this whole marketing team and brand team and stuff like that. But yeah, so that's just been our strategy, right? Like, you know, I built it myself, like in terms of like referral tracking and stuff like that, you know, it's a cookie and then we know who's who. Could probably benefit from using a tool like yours, but that was the positioning, right? Like we're going to offer the best value. So like if you're selecting between one of 10 products to promote, you're going to pick ours. And that's worked okay. You know, I think the better set of affiliates come from people who actually love the brand. So, you know, typically they're customers who then say, oh, this is amazing. I want to use this and tell people about it. And that's been where we've seen the most success. So like ultimately the value wasn't really the main driver. It was more just having like a product that people, you know, resonate with and got a lot of value out of and then wanted to share with other people. And they're like, oh, I can get some cash back. I'll do it. So yeah. So I'd say like that would be the better strategy than sort of just giving away the horse, but both work, you know, and it's been okay for us and I'm happy we did it.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned it because I had a founder of another affiliate tool here on the podcast, and that's exactly what he was saying. Like, it's not just a magic button that you press and, you know, people start selling your product. And sometimes that's why, you know, it doesn't really make sense for very early stage startups to have affiliate links because, well, then, yeah. You know, nobody really knows you and nobody knows the product, if it works, if it doesn't. Like if you post it on Product Hunt, let's say, with an affiliate link, I mean, is it going to work? Probably not. So yeah, when did you start with it? Like at what point, at what stage of the company?
Yeah, we started early. Probably, I mean, like you said, probably too early, right? Like, you know, I had it up there for probably 6 months before anyone, you know, even used it. So probably too early. But, you know, when you're starting, and no one or like very few people have installed your product, you kind of have to try everything. There's no real excuse not to. You know, granted, you want to see everything through and that's sort of like the catch 22 of everything, right? Like you want to do all the things, but you also want to do them all well. And well, you can't do that, but you have to try a lot of different things. And so that's just one of the things, you know, you could try. You will probably learn the same lesson, right? Which is that like the people who will adopt your product early who are looking for an affiliate link are probably not the people who can sell your product. the people who can sell your product are the people who are actually going to pay you for it, like just at a higher level, right? Like, agencies, are great affiliates, and sort of like influencers, like B2B influencers, which is a whole new thing that I didn't know existed until, we started this. That's a great sort of source of affiliates. But like, those people aren't looking on Product Hunt for, page two of the products, and wondering, oh, I can get an affiliate. This is how I'm going to, buy my yacht or whatever. That doesn't happen. Or at least I haven't been fortunate enough to have it happen to me, but I don't think it happens very often.
Yeah, completely agree. And, you're a solo founder and, all the time that you've been talking, I kept thinking, like, how do you pull that off? And I don't know how big the team is. How many people do you have now?
No, it's still just me. I have someone doing content from like a contract basis and someone helping with ads. That's been the two changes this year. But it's been on me.
Oh, right. So, okay. How does your week look like? Like, do you prioritize, like, I don't know, customer support on Monday and development on Tuesday?
That's maybe how I would answer you before kids. It changed. Like, rationally, that would make sense, right? Like, okay, today I'm going to do this. Tomorrow I'm going to have like a dev day. And that's probably maybe how I worked a little bit before. I have a 3-year-old, which explains the playhouse and the little chair behind me. But now it's kind of like, you're sort of at his mercy. So, it's basically where can you find the time? And I think the main, it's important to have heuristics, right? Like, so what's your main focus all the time? What's your North Star? And up until very recently, it was customer reviews, right? That was my North Star. You do whatever it takes. You drop anything in order to get a 5-star review. And I think that served me well. I think that's necessary to have at least, you need to have a North Star at all times in order to prioritize what you're doing. But that can change. So now I think that the North Star is more towards revenue. So it's going to change a little bit in sort of like what you focus on at any given point in time. I still do great customer service, I promise. So you basically just start your day. I think for me, it's always starting with email and also just having sort of like devoted blocks where you can work. And those change, depending on your schedule, right? Like before it was 9 to 5, like most normal people. But now it's not. Now it's, I get up at, start, I have an hour from 7 to 8 where I work, drop the kid off at school. Then we have, 9 to 11, pick the kid up from school. Then we have, maybe like 7 to 10 PM, right? So like, then we have those blocks and each one of those blocks, maybe it's something different. Maybe it's customer support. Maybe it's, developing a feature. Maybe it's, writing a blog article or something like that or LinkedIn at the end and sort of putting those things in the right spaces when you have the mental capacity to handle it, right? Like, I know I can do customer success first thing in the morning. I know I can do product development first thing in the morning. I know I can't do product development at night. I'm way too tired. Don't try. You will make mistakes. So just sort of rearranging the day based on that. I don't know if that would work for everybody. It's hard, to sort of like always be on and always be on call and stuff like that. But yeah, but that's the strategy so far. It's just doing what you can at that point in time and sort of like having an idea of what you can and can't do at certain windows of time are very helpful. Also, I work the weekends. I always am working, but the load is always enough where I can handle each day and not be burnt out. So maybe that sounds horrible to some people. I don't know. Maybe it sounds great. I'm not sure, but it works for me. And it's been working so far. I feel like the cadence of development and stuff is pretty good.
And yeah, in a way, like, thank you for being that honest about it, because I think there's so much like glamour around like being a founder that sometimes you're like, oh, well, but that's hard. Like, you work all the time and like, it's, I don't know. I think it's a bit like dishonest to try and put like, I don't know, rainbows and butterflies around it.
I love building stuff, right? Like, if I didn't love doing it, then it wouldn't make sense. It's fun. Like, I enjoy doing pretty much all of the tasks I enjoy doing somewhat. Like, even customer service. I mean, depending on the ticket, right? Like, I like talking to people. I love hearing, like, from small business owners and stuff like that. Like, it's very fun. So if I didn't, then this kind of sounds like a nightmare. But I do. So if you're doing this sort of thing, my recommendation is to like it, or at least like the sort of the section that you're in charge of, whether that's marketing or whether it's product development or whatever. Or if it's everything, like, I like to keep it interesting. I like to do multiple things. I feel like you don't need to be pigeonholed, but again, it's up to you. Like, people are different. I get that. So yeah, this works for me. But if you want to be sort of like a solo founder, I guess I will say You need to do a lot of different things. And if you think you're just going to do, like, I'm just going to build this product and the people are going to use it, which is sort of what I originally thought, that's not true. Like, you marketing is just as important, probably more important than product development. You know, granted, I like product development more, and I feel like having a good product will make your life a lot easier instead of harder. And if you're doing something that you don't enjoy doing as much, you should make your life easier, not harder. You know, use the advantages you have. But you have to do everything, you know, even designing your own logo and stuff like that. And unless you want to pay for it.
Yeah, fantastic. No, I and sometimes, I also think even if you're not alone, it's great if you like tap into your co-founder's way of doing things or their kind of like responsibilities, because then you also understand like 360 view on like what you're building and not like develop this tunnel vision. But everyone's different, every team is different. All right, I have just a couple more questions. That sounds super exciting. I actually thought that there are a couple more people because just looking at the scope of like
That's good. Yeah.
what's going on. And yeah, just a couple more questions that are usual here. And so far doing it all, selling on all those platforms and using all those growth channels, what has been the biggest win and the biggest failure? And it can be for the company or for you personally as a founder.
Good question. Biggest win and biggest failure. I'll talk about something interesting, which may or may not actually be a win or a failure, but I guess that's kind of the point of some of these questions anyway, right? Like, who knows? Yeah, so biggest win. So when COVID happened, I did a little detour, right? Like, I built Zigful in like 2019, 2020. And at first, you know, we didn't sort of hone in on the product market fit for a while. So I just sort of let it sit in the background, you know, just as like an on-site survey tool. It was like kind of okay, like in sort of like a limbo state. I think I was doing like, I don't know, 2-3K MRR or something, just sort of sitting there. I was like, all right, I'll take it. You know, I'll work on something else. And so I jumped ship and I worked on this, like COVID hit, and I had this other project, which, actually sold. It's called Jukebox, which was like a social listening community sort of thing. And so COVID happened. I'm like, okay, concerts, those are gone now. So I have this digital music community. Maybe I can pivot this into something for like digital listening parties, digital concerts and sell. And so I built this and I focused on it for like 3 months straight, you know, code. And it was great. It was this cool sort of like digital listening party platform where you could like basically put on like a virtual show where you would like chop up like YouTube content and Spotify content and all and the uploaded content, all sort of stuff. There's like a chat box on the side. And that went really so like and then I'm like, all right, I built it. I'm just sending out some emails to some music execs, see if they bite. You know, these are people who've contacted me previously from Jukebox. And one of them did bite, and I did sort of like this little detour of doing virtual concerts for, you know, Universal, Sony Music, Columbia, like all these like, and it did great, right? Like it netted, I think, close to like 400K, you know, from start to the end, you know, which is great for a start, right? Like if you have year one, I think it'd be like 175 grand, you'd be like, that's great, you know what I mean? Like by that logic, like I'm gonna be a billionaire soon. But it was very like time intensive, and like every concert took a lot of my time, right? So like I had to work probably, you know, 8 to 16 hours each time to do it, and then I'd have to actually like orchestrate them. There's like a manual component involved. Anyway, so long story short, that was a huge win, right? Like that was amazing. Like, you know, I saw a problem, I went for it, the results were great, you know. And then the biggest sort of failure is that like what I didn't realize, and what I think the trap that I think you can find often when sort of like building a new product is like it took too much of my time and it wasn't exactly scalable, right? Like, so like working in the music industry is hard because they have very high expectations. So they have people with, you know, these artists, some of the artists that I did, you know, products for or concerts for, you know, have 500 million plus followers on Twitter. And so they have these crazy expectations, but they have a very low budget because to them, this is just like one of like a million different marketing things that they're using in order to just like sell this thing. So you have like all this crazy traffic requirements. But the budget's low, you know, it's like 4 or 5 grand a concert, you know, it's not that much. And so it kind of just like was this long detour of like, okay, so this works, but you're kind of back in the service industry and it can't scale. So that doesn't work. And so I basically just sort of like burned 2 years doing this like very cool, hip sort of like detour in the virtual concert business. All the while, you know, Zigpulse are going on in the background And you know, when I finally looked back, I was like, oh wow, a lot of people are using this for post-purchase surveys. I should really focus on that. And so I wish I would have sort of done that sooner. You know, I feel like that, you know, that was sort of like a missed opportunity in pursuit of sort of searching for this other opportunity. So that's my story. That's my roller coaster story, right? Like biggest win, biggest failure, kind of the same thing. And it's like, are they even a win or a failure? You know, I don't know. Who's to say? But yeah, that's my story. That's my answer to your question.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Very, also kind of unexpected, but yeah. And COVID, okay, when was that?
Honestly, yeah.
That feels like a million years ago.
yeah, seriously.
But yeah, pretty great. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, the other one is always about a hack. And it can be, again, mm-hmm. it can be anything. It can be your, you know, personal kind of mental health, you know, hack that helps you go through this and then and juggle all those responsibilities. Or it can be something about, you know, growth of the product or development. So anything that works mm-hmm. and you think other founders would appreciate.
I think for me, opening up a time slot between 7 and 8 a.m. Has been important, more important than I thought. One, I think it's good to hit the ground running. You know, it's like a good spot for me when people are asleep. You know, you don't have as many support requests coming in. But two, because it opens up an entirely new market. So like I do a lot of calls with Europe. Like I didn't think that people would actually take me up on it. But you know, every morning, that's my most popular time is 7 to 8 a.m. Typically calls, you know, with people in Europe, you know, UK, Sweden, Germany, stuff like that. And that's letting me build a presence, overseas, that I don't think I would have had otherwise because they wouldn't have had the opportunity to chat with me and learn about the product, you know, because there's sort of a language barrier and stuff like that. So that to me has been a very productive hack that you sort of wouldn't expect, right? Just set your clock a little bit earlier or later, you know, depending on the kind of person you are. And I think doing so puts you ahead of a lot of more established players in the US market, you know, because, you know, they're only working 9 to 5 and you're going to miss a lot of people that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're doing it, 6 a.m. your time? So
right.
It's an early slot.
Yeah, and this is a great opportunity, you know, for me. So it would have been a missed opportunity if I wasn't willing to get up early, right? Like it's silly to let that slide. You know, just get up, have some coffee, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Okay. Great advice. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here and for making the time. You know, I really enjoyed the conversation and, you know, all the little tips and tricks that you share that help you build Zigbolt alone. And I mean, honestly, super impressed. Thanks so much for being here. Hope to do it again sometime.
Yeah, would love to. Yeah. And thanks for having me. Good questions. This was fun. Yeah. Hope whoever was listening enjoyed it, got something out of it. You can always email me, you know, feel free. I answer every sports ticket. So if you got a question about surveys, hit me up.
Cool. All right. Thank you so much and take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.